Chapter 43. Laura. Session number 16. 6 weeks ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
You must have wondered about who he was. That man who pulled Mitch Adler from the car and killed him in the road.
Laura. I told myself it was Lionel Casey. He was found living in the car. He drove it into the woods as far as it would go, and then he used it for shelter. Dr. Brody.
But it's possible someone else drove it there, to hide it, and that Casey stumbled upon it after the fact. That's what his defense team said, right?
Laura. Who else then? Who else wanted him dead? They obviously didn't want the car if they left it in the woods. Dr. Brody.
You had the bat in your hands, blood on your clothing, even though you were standing several feet from the body. Do you remember, Laura? Do you remember if you swung that bat?
Chapter 44. Laura. Present day. Saturday, 2:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. 36 hours have passed, and I am still in Gabe's house, hiding now behind the door of his basement. I spent many afternoons here when I was a child, playing games in the dark with Gabe and other kids in our neighborhood, so I know it well. I know every window that looks to the outside. I know the door that leads to the boiler room, and how at the end of that room is a Bilco hatch that opens to his backyard. No one lived down here. The basement isn't finished, so it's clammy in the summer and ice cold in the winter, unless you huddle beside the water heater. I wait now, hiding at the top of the stairs, waiting for the door to open, holding a bat in my hands. Gabe had set up a makeshift bedroom here before we arrived. A mattress on the floor with a pillow and some old fleece blankets, a flashlight, and a bucket that he said I should use to go to the bathroom. He told me not to go upstairs, where a neighbor might see me through a window, or the police if they showed up. He told me not to peek out the small basement windows for the same reason, and he told me to leave through the Bilco doors if I heard three thuds on the ceiling. He said he would stomp his feet three times on the floor above, and that would be the signal to escape. I have not slept. I have cycled through terror at being blamed for what happened to Jonathan Fielding, and relief that Gabe saved me, and that I might not have been found. But then all of that disappeared and left me with the horror that another man might be dead, and dead because of me. Gabe stayed with me until daybreak Friday morning, sitting beside the bed watching me sleep, although I was only pretending. I didn't want him to know what was on my mind. The doubts about what he had done to Jonathan, whether it had been necessary, and what that said about Gabe. And I didn't want him to come closer to me, to touch me or try to comfort me, because he'd been looking at me and speaking to me in ways that were unfamiliar. And that made me worry that I never really understood him or our relationship. And why would I? This is my defect, and I should have known that it applied not just to men on dates, but to everyone, even my closest friend, and perhaps even to my family. In the morning, he got a call from Rosie. I saw him answer it and speak to her calmly, saying he would be right over. What happened? I asked him when he ended the call.
The police have come to her house. They're looking for you, just like I said they would.
Does Rosie know where I am? I asked.
Of course she does. It was all part of our plan to keep you safe. But I have to go now, and I might not be back for several hours. It would seem strange to the police if I didn't try to help them find you. There's food in the spare refrigerator. Do you remember where it is?
He asked me. In the utility room, I answered him. We used to hide beer there when we were in high school.
Right, he said. And remember, if you hear three thuds from above, that's your cue to go out the Bilco hatch. But not unless you hear them, okay? Do you understand? The neighbors could see you.
I nodded, and he leaned over onto the bed and kissed my forehead. His eyes were wide with excitement, like this was some top-secret military operation, and he was our general. He had never been our leader when we were younger. It was always Joe, or me at times. He liked to follow. I used to think it made him feel safe to be with strong people, people who could stand up to his brother the way I had done. Maybe that's why I'd never seen this look before. Maybe it wasn't strange, but just new. A new Gabe who had grown from the shadows after Rick left for good to join the army. This is what I told myself as he walked up the stairs. The bright light of day rushed into the dark space, but then disappeared along with Gabe when he closed the door behind him. He returned sometime that afternoon. I don't know what time it was or how long he'd been gone. I only know that it had felt like forever. I had found sandwiches in the refrigerator, peanut butter and jelly on white bread. I used to eat those in hordes when I was little, and it was both sweet and eerie that he remembered and had gone to the trouble to fix them, wrapping them carefully in plastic baggies. There were bottles of water and grape soda. I used the bucket to pee, like he said, and emptied it in a utility sink and ran the hot water for a long time. Then I ran it cold and splashed it on my face. I ran it through my hair, which still smelled of Jonathan Fielding, if that was even possible. But it had been wrapped in his hands, pressed against his chest. The smell of him, of his cologne and his sweat, made me feel sick inside. Is he dead? I wondered this every minute Gabe was gone. When he returned, the light was not as bright as when it came through the door or peeked through the tiny windows, so I imagined it was late afternoon. What happened? I asked him. Is he still alive?
I don't know, he said. But Rosie and Joe are fine. The police won't leave them alone. We'll give it one more day, and then I'll get you out of here. You'll ride in the trunk of my car, and we'll drive until we find someplace safe.
What about Melissa? I asked. He'd said she was traveling for work, but surely she would be home for the weekend. And one more night would make it Saturday, unless I had lost track of time entirely.
Don't worry about my wife. She's away for work. She won't come back until we're gone.
And Rosie? I started to cry then. I don't want to leave, Gabe. I don't want to leave what's left of my life. He took me by the arms then and shook me hard. The excitement left his face, and what came instead was anger. The general dressing down his soldier.
I've gone to a lot of effort, taken a lot of risks and thrown away my life to save you. You could be a little grateful and do what you're told.
I was quiet then, choking back my tears, choking back the terror that was now raw and full on.
Okay?
He asked me, his voice growing softer. I nodded. Okay, Gabe. I was afraid to say anything else.
I have to leave as soon as Rosie calls again.
The call didn't come for a long time. Hours upon hours. I asked Gabe what time it was, but he said it was best if I didn't know. He said it would make me anxious. He went upstairs to speak to her, then he returned. He said I should sleep, so I lay back down and pretended to sleep, and felt his eyes never leave me as he sat by the mattress. The next call came when it was light again. He shook me, though I wasn't asleep, and told me he had to go.
Don't come upstairs, he reminded me, or go outside, not unless you hear three thuds on the ceiling.
I know, I said. He'd repeated the instructions over and over, so I didn't question him. I knew I could be wrong about what I was thinking, but in the end I would have to decide. I had to trust reasoning that had proven to be untrustworthy without fail. And what I was thinking was that Gabe had lost his mind. He was gone for the second time, and when I heard the car pull away, I climbed up on an old trunk and peeked out the small window that faced the front of the house. I saw his car disappear down the driveway and toward the top of Deer Hill Lane. I climbed down from the trunk and ran up the stairs to the door. I didn't know where I would go, but I would look for Rosie's purse, which had my phone, and try to charge it and call her. Or I would find a computer or a phone in the house, or I would simply run, out of this house and through the woods that led to the preserve. I knew every inch of it, and I would hide until I could find out what was going on. I reached the top step, crazy with fear.
and I put my hand on the knob and turned. But it wouldn't open. I turned one way and it stopped. I turned the other way and it stopped. The door was locked from the outside. I tried pulling on it hard. Maybe it would break open. But it was strong, and I remember when we entered that it had a deadbolt as well. I couldn't remember if I heard it slide close when he left, but I didn't have time to find out. I ran back down the stairs and through the door to the utility room, past the water heater and the refrigerator, to the very back corner, where there were cement steps and the two large folding doors of the Bilco hatch. I slid the latch to open them and pushed against the outer one. I'd opened these doors 100 times, and they hadn't been changed. But the door wouldn't budge more than an inch, and I could see through that inch the links of a metal chain locking that door from the outside as well. I screamed out in frustration, once, twice. I folded over and screamed again, pounding my fists into my legs. There was no other way out. The windows didn't open and were too small for a body to squeeze through. Just two doors, that was it. And they were both locked. I was not being rescued, saved from the police and the crimes I didn't commit. I was a prisoner. Gabe's prisoner. Something inside me gave way then. Locked doors would not stop me from getting out of this house. I began a search. Every inch of this basement would be torn apart until I found something I could use to cut the chains or break down the door. I started in the corner by the mattress and worked my way around, opening boxes of old memorabilia, his mother's clothing, framed photos. One of them was of Rick, the one on top, and I wondered if Gabe came down here and stared at it, and if that was what made him crazy, remembering the lifetime of abuse he suffered in this house at the hands of his brother. So many secrets on this godforsaken road. How had his parents not seen it? How had they not stopped it until it was too late to undo the damage? It was becoming clear. This picture of Gabe, so different from the one I had growing up. Dr. Brody had seen it. Kevin. He asked me frequently about the Wallace family as he got to know me. I thought he was just appalled by the negligence of his parents, but it was more than that. I put the picture back in the box, and then remembered the last time he asked me about Gabe and Rick. Where was Gabe the night Mitch Adler was killed? I thought I had the answer. I believed what everyone believed, that he had gone back early to college. But then he was there the next day. He came to cheer me up after he found out what had happened. He came to be my protector, just like he'd done now. He said he'd protected me my whole life. He said he'd protected me from his brother. And then he told me I had to stop being with men who wanted to hurt me and use me. He mentioned Mitch Adler when he said it, and Dr. Brody. He mentioned Kevin. I didn't stop to put this together, although it was coming together all on its own. That night in the woods, the man who pulled Mitch Adler from the car was strong and quick, not the body of an old man who lived in the woods. It was Gabe. The thought exploded in a violent scream. I closed my eyes and tried to see him, see his face as he opened that door and dragged Mitch from the car. But I didn't see it. I never saw the face. I hid in the bushes by the side of the road. I waited until the car was gone. And then I picked up the bat. What did I do then? I can never remember. I moved frantically then, tearing open every box and trunk, finding things, clothing and boots and luggage, and finally, a bag of sports equipment. I stopped with those. Golf club, hockey skates, baseball bat. Remnants from Gabe's childhood. If I could slip the blade through the crack in the Bilco doors, and then hit it hard with the club or bat, it might break the chain. I took the skates and hockey stick back to the utility room and set them down next to the door. And when I did, I saw a small opening, a crawl space, with a duffel bag inside. It was strange, because that crawl space always flooded in the winter when the ground was too hard or cold to absorb the groundwater. They never kept anything in there. I reached inside and pulled the strap. It was unbelievably heavy. I grabbed it with two hands and pulled it with all my weight until, finally, it slid close enough for me to open the zipper.
A quick pull. It opened easily. But then I jerked my hands away and stared at the contents as the sides fell apart. It took a moment to understand what I saw, and every possible thought rushed in to make it not be what it was. A doll, a mannequin, a Halloween prop. No. There were toes and feet and two grayish-white calves. The toes were painted red from a pedicure. Human toes, human feet, human legs. I couldn't scream. My chest wouldn't move, wouldn't draw air. I pulled the zipper farther, knowing what I was about to find, but still needing to see it with my eyes. As I unzipped the bag and the sides fell fully open, each part of her was revealed. Feet, calves, thighs, folded up to her chest. Her side, an arm, and then, at the top fold of the bag, Melissa's long black hair. I did not see any blood. I did not know how long she had been there, but her limbs were stiff and cold. I zipped the bag up and pushed it back into the crawlspace. I was not able to escape. I was not able to break the chains with the hockey skate or the bat or the golf club. I was not able to break down the door. So I did the only thing I could do. Hours have passed again as I stand now behind the door at the top of the stairs, waiting for my best friend, waiting for my captor. This time, waiting to kill someone.
Chapter 45. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 4 p.m., Branston, Connecticut. Joe didn't answer, so she left him a message. The same message she'd left for Gabe back at the police station. Call me as soon as you get this. She drove north, away from downtown, but now she didn't know where she was going. Home? The police would be there, going through Laura's things. Joe said he would go to the house to relieve the sitter, to be with Mason. God, what must he be thinking? Aunt Lala gone, his parents coming and going, on edge, frantic. Maybe she should go there too. She also had to call her mother, tell her to get on the next plane. Yes, she thought, home was where she should go. But something was tugging at her. A thought. A question. How did they get so far afield? Chasing a man who had no connection to Laura. She'd been so certain. Gabe had been so certain. Laura's phone had died at the harbor. Only it hadn't. And Edward Riddle had fit the profile of Jonathan Fields. Only he was a different man. Yet Edward Riddle was at the bar by the harbor. He went there every Thursday night with a different woman. And, the biggest coincidence, though not really given the abundance of apartments, both men lived in apartments near Richmond Street. Rosie pulled the car off to the side of the road. She grabbed her phone and tried Joe again. Still no answer. She tried Gabe. No answer. She left a message for Laura's roommate in New York, though she couldn't imagine Laura would have gone there after so much time had passed. Then she decided. It was Gabe who would know how all of this happened. Gabe could call the woman at the phone company and ask why she'd told them the wrong information. And Gabe said he was going home to look into Jonathan Fielding, so maybe he would have something the police didn't. Something lurid or criminal. Something on another dating website. Maybe with another woman. Maybe they could expose him as well, the way they'd exposed Edward Riddle. And maybe he was even worse. Maybe it would help Laura if they found out. God help me. These thoughts were terrible. The man had been assaulted and was in a coma. But maybe he did something and Laura had to defend herself. Or maybe it had nothing to do with Laura at all. Yes, that could be it. Maybe someone else attacked him and Laura had run for her life. Raw, nervous energy surged through her as she thought her way out of that horrible box where her sister had committed this violent act. Yes, she thought. There were other possibilities. And as horrible as they were, they left a strange kind of hope that only one person would understand. Rosie pulled back onto the road and headed toward Gabe's house.
Chapter 46. Laura. present day. Saturday, 4:15 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. I hear his car pull into the driveway. I hear the garage door open, a silent hum that vibrates through the walls. I hear it close. Footsteps now, across the floor in his kitchen. They are light and deliberate, so as not to alarm me and make me run for the Bilco hatch to make my escape. How clever he was to tell me that, to make me believe the doors would open by repeating it over and over. I didn't even think to check, to doubt him, until I saw the change in his face and his voice. It occurs to me now that I was right this time, that the broken reasoning inside my head worked. I had sensed something amiss, and for once in my life, I'd been right about it. I squeeze the bat in my hands, but the tightening of my fingers does not soothe me. My fists for hands, they bring no comfort. I want to turn back time and be in Rosie's attic, under the covers, safe, loved. It would be enough now. That would be enough. The footsteps grow louder, the click of his heels against the wood, the floorboards creaking. He's just outside the door, just on the other side. I hold my breath for fear he can hear me, the air going in and out, heavy, and the pounding in my chest. He is so quiet. I can feel him, mere inches away now. My head grows light, dizzy. I wait for the sound of the deadbolt. I stare at the doorknob, waiting for it to turn. But then another sound, another car pulling up the driveway. His feet move away, two steps back. Then he is quiet, listening the way I am. A car door opens and closes, and then the doorbell rings.
Gabe?
The voice calls from outside the house. Rosie's voice. With the bat still in my hands, I race down the stairs and slide a trunk beneath one of the windows again. I look outside and see her car, the blue minivan. They found it. They found the car. I think now that they must know where I am. But then why is Rosie here alone? Where are the police? Then a horrible thought. Gabe said Rosie and Joe were helping him. Maybe he's fooled them. Maybe they all think I hurt Jonathan Fielding, and now I have to be saved from myself. But why? To what end? What does Gabe want with me? Floorboards shift above my head as he walks to the front door. I can't see Rosie, but I can hear her voice clearer now, just outside.
Gabe?
She calls out. The footsteps turn to shuffles just outside the front door. Then the turn of a lock. And the door opens.
Chapter 47. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 4:20 p.m., Branston, Connecticut.
Gabe, where have you been? I've been calling you.
Rosie walked inside the house the way she always did. It was strangely quiet today, and dark. She looked around and noticed the shades and curtains were all pulled shut, and the lights were off. Gabe stood still, his hands in his pockets. His expression was strange, like a little boy caught stealing candy. Rosie started rattling off the things that had happened. The man Laura called from her phone was named Jonathan Fielding. He'd been assaulted and was unconscious. They wouldn't know anything from him for a few days. The police were at her house, looking through Laura's things, her computer. Joe had rushed off to be with Mason, and he wasn't answering his phone either.
What is it with the two of you? She asked. Anyway,
she told him about the records from the phone company, how they said Laura's phone died on Richmond Street, not by the harbor. Fielding's apartment was near Richmond Street, just like Riddle's, which explained the car being found there.
Can you call your contact back? Find out why she said that about the phone? Maybe Laura charged it in between the two signals.
Gabe didn't move. Not one muscle. Not even his eyes blinked. If he hadn't been standing up, she would have wondered if he was even alive.
I know you were researching Edward Riddle, but we need to find out more about Jonathan Fielding. That's the man she was with last night. The man in the coma. I think maybe he's into something bad, something criminal, and Laura just got mixed up in it. Don't you think? Isn't that possible?
The theories that had seemed possible inside her head were suddenly absurd as she said them out loud. Most things were exactly what they seemed. The simplest answer was usually right. These were things Joe used to say.
Joe, where are you? Gabe, what if there's really something wrong with her? What if she hurt this man and is running now, scared and alone?
Rosie fell into Gabe, wrapping her arms around his neck as she started to cry. She waited to feel his arms wrap around her back, for his voice to calmly tell her it would all be okay. They would find Laura, and they would help her through this. But he didn't move. He stood straight and stiff like a piece of wood. Rosie didn't move either then, except to open her eyes. She looked beyond his shoulder into the next room, the kitchen, and then stopped breathing. On the counter was her black purse.
Chapter 48. Laura. Present day. Saturday, 4:25 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Rosie. I climb down from the trunk and back up the stairs to the door. I press my ear against it, but all is quiet now. I move quickly back down the stairs and into the utility room to the Bilco hatch. I don't look into the crawl space where Gabe's wife is folded into a bag. I have to create a distraction. Gabe won't want to hurt Rosie. He will want her to leave so he can finish his plan, put me into the trunk of his car and drive out of town. I know that's what he wants. He's gone to great lengths to make this plan, to execute it. He's made me sandwiches and a soft bed. He stroked my hair while he thought I was sleeping. He wants to finish the plan, and his plan does not include getting rid of Rosie's body. Gabe told me to leave through the Bilco hatch if I heard three thuds on the ceiling. He had been careful with his footsteps. But maybe Rosie had been louder than he realized. Maybe I heard thuds when Rosie walked into the house, and maybe I'm trying to follow the plan and escape from the house. I put the bat down against the wall and grab both handles of the Bilco hatch. Then I push hard against the chains, making the doors rattle. I push again and again and again.
Chapter 49. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 4:25 p.m., Branston, Connecticut. Slowly, gently, she released her arms from around Gabe's neck. Laura was inside this house. Gabe had been lying the whole time. That explained why he'd sent them off in the wrong direction, chasing the wrong man at the wrong bar. It explained why he'd been so assertive, so strong for her and Joe in the face of Laura's disappearance. And it explained why he was behaving so strangely now that she was here, inside this house, so close to Laura. The question now was whether Laura was safe here, whether she was hiding somewhere, as desperate as Gabe was for Rosie to leave, or whether she was hiding somewhere, desperate for Rosie to find her.
I'm sorry,
she said, the way she would have hours before when she had no reason to doubt him.
I'm just so scared.
She turned to face the living room, away from the kitchen, so he would have no reason to wonder if she'd seen the purse.
Is Melissa home?
She asked, now covering for why she had looked away and into another room. She turned back to Gabe, and he opened his mouth as though he was going to answer, but then they both turned toward the bay window that looked out into the backyard.
What is that? Rosie asked.
There was a banging sound, metal against metal. She started to walk toward the window to open the curtains and look outside, but Gabe grabbed her arm, his fingers digging deeply into her skin.
It's nothing, he said. The screen door out back doesn't latch anymore. The slightest wind will blow it against the frame.
He smiled then, his face returning to normal.
It's been driving me crazy all summer. Melissa will be home soon. That's why I'm in a bit of a state, honestly, with everything happening with Laura. Well, you know how she feels about her.
Rosie nodded.
I'm sorry, Gabe, she said. I should go. I'm sure the police can find out about the phone. And they're already digging into Jonathan Fielding's past, so they'll find whatever there is to find. I'm just impatient and worried.
Gabe released his grip and led her back to the front door. It's fine, Rosie. You know I want to help if I can. Call me later. I promise I'll answer this time.
Rosie felt a final surge of fear as she stepped outside the house. She could see her car. She was so close to safety. But then Laura.
The sound came again, metal on metal from behind the house. It was louder now that they were outside.
You should get that fixed,
Rosie said. Her mouth was dry, the words barely making it out. I know. I will. Gabe closed the door quickly, and Rosie heard the turn of the locks. She didn't look back. She got in her car, then took out her phone and called Joe.
Chapter 50. Laura. Present day. Saturday, 4:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Loud footsteps across the floor above me. I let go of the doors and race back to the foot of the stairs, the bat in my hands. I hear the bolt. I see the doorknob turn. There's no time to get back up the stairs, behind the door where I can hide. I place the bat against the wall near my feet. I hold on to the stair rail and look up to the door. I watch it open and wait.
Chapter 51. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 4:30 p.m., Branston, Connecticut.
Joe!
Rosie was frantic as she sat in her car, staring at Gabe's house. Where are you? Joe asked.
I'm at Gabe's. I think Laura is here. I saw my purse. The one she borrowed?
Joe started yelling into the phone. Get out of there! Right now!
Back and forth, short bursts of information, each of them trying to catch up with the other.
Joe was frantic as he told her what he'd found in his office files. That man, Edward Riddle. I remembered the name from a case. Gabe worked it. Riddle was seeing our client's wife. Gabe found him the same way he did yesterday. He knew this guy was on the website. He knew he was a cheater and a liar, and he knew where he took women. Rosie, it was all a setup.
I know, Rosie cried the words. Why, Joe? Why would he do that?
Joe was running now. She could hear his feet pounding against the pavement. It's Laura. He wants Laura.
Why? Why now?
Rosie's eyes never left the house. There was no movement inside, no lights coming on. No sound. It doesn't matter. Just get out of there. I'm calling the police. Rosie grew silent, thinking.
What about the notes, Joe? And her boyfriend in New York? God, I never even told you what I found. He's dead, Joe. The boyfriend in New York was killed in a robbery. Laura had no idea. Do you think?
Joe stopped running. Rosie, he said, his voice serious now. Get out of there.
Okay, call the police. I'm leaving. I promise.
Joe hung up and Rosie put the phone down on the passenger seat. She put her hand on the key and started to turn the ignition. But then she stopped. The sound was gone, the metal against metal. It wasn't the screen door banging in the wind. She knew what it was now. It was Laura.
Chapter 52. Laura. Present day. Saturday, 4:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Gabe, I say in a whisper when he comes to the door. I heard thuds. I tried to get out. What's going on? Gabe shuffles down the stairs quickly and in a panic. He takes my arms and ushers me away from the stairs, out of the line of sight from anyone who might open that door.
It was nothing, just an unexpected guest. But you did the right thing, just like I told you. Good girl, he says. Good girl.
I say nothing about the doors being chained from the outside, and Gabe doesn't wonder why.
Are they gone now?
I ask. Gabe looks to the window that faces the driveway and strains his neck to see through it.
I can't tell, he says.
I moved the trunk from beneath the window, but just beyond it is the bag with the sports equipment, which I've left open. Shit. I pull Gabe's attention back to me, hoping he won't see. Gabe! He looks at me again. What do we do now? Is it time to leave? He shakes his head.
No, there's been a complication, but it'll be fine.
What complication? Do they know I'm here? Are they coming? Gabe pulls me to his chest and wraps his arms around me tight. Every inch of my skin crawls at his touch, at his smell. But I grab hold of his arms and squeeze them as though I never want to let him go. I'm scared, I say. I have to make him believe me. He wants to be my protector, and I will make him just that. But then his body jerks away from me. His head turns back toward the window, back to the open bag with the sports equipment. He walks to it with large strides, looking inside.
What were you doing while I was gone?
He asks. When he looks back, I'm standing by the foot of the stairs, one foot on the first step, and the bat gripped tightly in my hands. He freezes for a second, stunned by my deception, but I am already moving. Up the second step, and then the third. He runs to the stairs. I bound them two at a time. I reach the top and grab the doorknob, this time turning it all the way. The door opens into me, and I have to step down to make way. And when I do, I feel his hand on my ankle, pulling me hard to my knees, and then down the stairs, toward the bottom, toward Gabe.
Why?
He yells as he grabs hold of my other ankle. He drags me to the bottom of the stairs like a rag doll, the bat releasing from my hands and falling through the railing to the floor below. He climbs on top of me, hands gripping my wrists, legs pinning my thighs to the ground.
I did everything for you. Don't you understand that? I saved you from my brother, and then I saved you from Mitch Adler. You knew it was me. I know you saw me. I looked at you when I opened that car door and saw you with your shirt pulled up and his hands on you. You would never let him do that to you. I know that. But you always got yourself into trouble, didn't you?
I feel his hot breath against my skin. His eyes are crazy now, like a dam is broken, and whatever he's been holding inside is now free.
I saved you again from that monster in New York. I made him disappear, and it never touched you, did it? I always clean up your messes and then make sure it never touches you, precious Laura. Nothing can ever touch precious Laura.
I look in his eyes then and let my face soften. I stop fighting against his hold and let my body go limp. I know, Gabe, I tell him. I've caused so much trouble, haven't I? I'm sorry. You've always been so good to me, but I'm scared, don't you understand? I don't know if I can trust you. I don't know if I can trust anyone. That's always been my problem, remember? I can't tell the good guys from the bad guys. Gabe lifts my wrists and then slams them down in anger.
You never could, he yells. You liked it when he kissed you. I know you did. You kissed him for a long time and in front of everyone.
But then the anger subsides.
I thought you would finally understand when the notes started to come. I thought you would realize that I was the good guy. I was the one you could turn to. But you didn't, did you? You went on a dating website and put on makeup like a little whore. I couldn't let you do that again. I couldn't let you not see the truth that I'm the only one who protects you. I'm the only one.
I nod and try to smile, though my mouth is trembling. Gabe killed Mitch Adler. Gabe sent the notes. And Kevin, what did he mean about making him disappear? My voice trembles when I speak. I know, Gabe. Give me some time. Teach me. I can learn. I can be better. We both hear footsteps coming from above. Gabe looks to the top of the stairs and the door that is now open. He climbs off me and pulls us both to the wall at the foot of the stairway, where we can't be seen. In the corner, I see the bat, and I break free long enough to get to it. I stand tall now, Gabe right in front of me. and I clutch the bat in both hands. Sirens pierce the silence that has filled the room. Sirens. And then the sound of my sister's voice, calling my name.
Chapter 53. Rosie. Present day. Saturday, 4:32 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Rosie couldn't wait. Not one second longer. She left the car and ran to the door at the side of the garage. It opened the same way it always had, from the time they were kids. The frame was warped, the lock misaligned. She moved quickly to the toolbox on a small workbench in the corner and lifted it. The key was there, just like always. She ran to the side door that led to the house, turned the key, and opened the door, stepping just inside. The side door led to the mudroom, and then the kitchen. She slowed herself now because the house was quiet. Gabe would have heard her enter. He could be anywhere, around any corner. She walked past the small island and then the counter where he'd placed her black purse. She saw a butcher block with a set of knives and grabbed one from the back, one with a large blade. She held it with both hands, propped in front of her, and walked slowly with her back against the wall until she reached the entrance to the living room. She heard voices coming from the basement. The door was open. She approached it slowly, listening, the knife in her hands. At the top of the stairs, she stopped.
Laura!
She called out. Sirens rang out in the distance. The police would be here in mere moments.
Laura!
She called out again. Then she walked through the door.
Chapter 54. Laura. Present day. Saturday, 4:35 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Gabe turns to see Rosie standing at the top of the stairs, but I don't look away from my target. I raise the bat high behind my head. Gabe! Rosie calls his name now. Just back away. Everything is all right now. The police are just up the street. Can't you hear them? Step away from Laura. My knuckles go white. I can feel them the way I always do when the fists come. I want to swing it down against him, strike him in the chest, send him to the ground. My mind flashes back to that night in the woods. The bat in my hands. Mitch Adler at my feet, blood pooling around his head. I tell my arms to move, but they don't listen. And then I know. With every part of me, I know the answer to the last question Dr. Brody asked me. I did not swing the bat. I did not level the fatal blow to Mitch Adler. Rosie is moving down the stairs now, the knife in her hands. Gabe is afraid of her. I can see it in his eyes. He's afraid of Rosie and what she might do to him. Rosie, who's never lifted her finger against a living soul. But Rosie, who would give her life for mine. Who would take a life for mine. Gabe lifts his hands in the air and steps back just as Rosie reaches the last step. We hear knocking on the front door and then feet pounding the floorboards. Officers appear at the top of the stairs, guns drawn. I feel my fingers release. The bat drops to the ground. And my fists turn to open hands, just as Rosie pulls me into her open arms. Chapter 55. Laura. Before the sessions. 5 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
Is it strange dating a shrink?
Laura.
As long as you don't try to shrink me.
Dr. Brody.
I'll try.
Laura.
It is strange dating a man with kids. And a wife.
Dr. Brody.
It won't be strange when you meet them, finally. And she's a soon-to-be ex-wife. She left me, remember? For her high school boyfriend, no less. But then I met you.
Laura.
But then you met me. I hope you're not sorry about that day.
Dr. Brody.
How could I ever be sorry I met you?
Chapter 56. Laura. Present day. Saturday, 10 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. I feel cold. Joe has brought a blanket and Rosie has wrapped it around me, but it can't touch the place where I feel it most. Two men are dead. Another came close. Jonathan Fielding, where this latest chapter began. They say he'll make it. His body will recover, but he won't recover in other ways. Every time his hand reaches for a lock to open a door, he will feel the fear. I think about his caution, his concerns about my past, all the questions, relentless questions. I convinced myself they were unusual, that they made him suspect. But in the end, he was right to be concerned, wasn't he? Two men are dead. Two men. The first, Mitch Adler, my high school obsession, dragged from his car and beaten to death with a baseball bat. Gabe had been watching from deep in the woods, the preserve where we spent days upon days together, alone, and with Rosie and Joe. Hours, days, years. None of us ever saw it. None of us ever knew what was happening inside our friend. His brother's abuse was worse than I even knew, and I thought I knew everything. It had been going on for years. There was a file at social services, visits from caseworkers to their home, right next door to us. Our mother now says that Mrs. Wallace confided in her about Rick, all those afternoons when they were in the kitchen together. Our mother crying about Dick and his infidelities. Mrs. Wallace crying about her twisted, violent son who enjoyed tormenting his little brother. Both women keeping secrets that would lead to people dying. Our mother is on a plane now. She has no idea what she will face when she sees us. Me, Rosie, and Joe. My half-brother. The second man, Dr. Kevin Brody, was killed in an alley outside his gym in the early morning hours. I'm in shock, they say, which is why I haven't cried yet. But the tears will come. I met Kevin at a coffee shop one Saturday morning. His wife was leaving him, but they couldn't afford for either to move out of the apartment. Kevin left on Saturdays. She left on Sundays. They both needed some space, and to be alone with their children. It was crowded that morning, and he asked if he could sit with me at my small table with the extra chair. I moved my bag and let him sit. 4 weeks later, he told me he loved me, and it was the first time I ever believed it. Now I wonder if it will be the last. I'm the reason he's dead. I am the reason his children don't have a father. I may as well have beaten him myself and left him to die. It may as well have been me. They found Kevin's phone in Gabe's house. He sent me the text I thought was from Kevin, the one ending things for good. It was so concise and so believable that I didn't question it. I didn't try to reach him or see him. I didn't seek out a more complicated explanation. Instead, I invited the pain in, opened the door wide, and put out a welcome mat. And I let it nearly destroy me, leaving my job, my home, my life, returning to the scene of the crime, the place of my childhood, where it all began. I know what he would say, because after a short while, I asked him to help me understand my mind. I could see that he was different, that he was not like the other men I had pulled close, only to push them away or be hurt by them, devastated, immersed in pain that was so familiar. I suppose this is a gift he left me, this understanding of my mind, which, ironically, I can now believe in. Jonathan Fielding, the third man. He is everything he said he was, just a man, a guy, stumbling his way through life, through his mother's death and his divorce and his job and his car needing repair, and trying to be sexy again as a single man with a younger woman. Loneliness, hope, desire. All of it had been real. Everything he said to me had been true. And now he has paid the price for that. More facts have come out in the past several hours. Gabe had seen a therapist throughout his teen years. He had a breakdown in college and spent 3 months as an inpatient. We were all told he was studying abroad. As for Rick, he joined the army right after he graduated from military school. After a long string of violent outbursts, he was eventually dishonorably discharged and later sent to prison for a gruesome bar fight that left a man dead. Violence, secrets, mental illness. Right next door in the Wallace's house. Two men dead. And also one woman. Melissa Wallace was strangled to death and stuffed in a bag. She'd never gone on a business trip. She just got too nosy. Too angry at her husband's obsessions. She got in the way. I've gone over every detail of my life with the investigators, from the first memory of my childhood to knocking Rick Wallace off Gabe by the fort, to kissing Rick in a game of spin the bottle, and all of the things I knew about his violence toward Gabe. I told them about the night in the woods and how I didn't see him, how I didn't know it was Gabe, and how I now know that I did not swing that bat, not once. After I left for college, there were other strange incidents that now raise questions. Men who left suddenly and without much explanation. These were my wolves, the wrong men I chose so they would hurt me. So I could try to make them love me, but then prove to myself I was unlovable, so I could play the old record of my childhood over and over. We are drawn to the familiar, even if it hurts us. But now I wonder which ones were wolves, and which ones left because of Gabe. There was a guy freshman year who told me he couldn't date someone with a crazy ex-boyfriend. At the time, I thought maybe he meant Mitch Adler. I thought he'd discovered my real last name, like Jonathan Fielding had, and read about my past and that night in the woods. I told the investigators about it, and they are tracking him down. I suppose he will tell them that Gabe paid him a visit. Gabe knew everything about my life because I told him, every bad date, every painful breakup. He was always there to comfort me, and in his mind, to protect me. But what did he do with this knowledge? I fear what we will find. Rosie and Joe sit with me in the room. Rosie said it is the same room where she saw my phone records, and where Joe confessed what he knew about the past just hours before. A forensic psychologist is with us, along with a young man who was training to be one. He is going to learn a lot today. I just don't understand, Rosie says. She said it a dozen times since we got here. I can feel her remorse, though she has been nothing but heroic. Joe sits quietly now that he has all the facts. He seems to understand Gabe in a way that we don't. He sits between us, one arm around Rosie and another around me. We huddle together in a giant heap of emotional chaos. The forensic psychologist mostly asks questions, but she also tries to explain the possible scenarios. Sometimes during a childhood trauma, especially one that is ongoing, the child will create an unrealistic attachment to someone who makes him feel safe. That person becomes so crucial to his emotional survival that he has to have her all to himself. In this case, it is possible that Gabe developed an attachment to Laura. You said she was brave, even though she was just a little girl. Joe nods and even smiles a little like he's proud of me, proud that he's my brother.
She was brave and fierce.
But all I can think is that everything I was and everything I did back then contributed to this psychotic attachment that has now left three people dead. The psychologist nods as well.
And Laura, you were the only one who knew about his brother, right?
Except for his mother and my mother, I say, and I cannot hide my anger.
But Gabe only told you, and you were the only one who tried to stop it. That's what matters. You became essential to his survival.
Rosie sniffles now, even though the tears are gone.
I don't understand, she says again.
Why didn't he try to be with her? To date her or be physical with her in any way? Why didn't he try to marry her when they were older?
Now a shrug and a tilt of the head. She doesn't know, but she offers a theory.
It's likely he needed to keep those things separate.
Sexualizing Laura risked making her vulnerable or weaker in his eyes. The act of sex involves a kind of submission by both parties. It exposes us in ways we don't share with everyone. I suspect he needed to keep her pure. I lean forward now. Something bothers me about all this. Gabe said he was my protector. He said he had to protect me from the men I was with. But you're saying he saw me as his protector? Again, it's just a theory, she says. But I think he needed to create a justification for making sure you were always available, because he needed you to belong only to him. That became difficult after you all grew up and started looking for partners. He found one, but I doubt she ever really knew him. He would have hidden himself from her. He would have compartmentalized her, his sexual partner, his roommate, his cover with the outside world to appear normal. But Laura, he needed you to be alone so that in his mind you belonged only to him. He told himself he was doing this all for you, to protect you, so he could justify it. She leans her elbows on the table and shakes her head. Then she looks at her intern and speaks more to him than to us. These types of psychoses are extremely complex. There are layers upon layers of ego that have to be managed. Gabe didn't want to see himself as a vulnerable, needy little boy who let his brother abuse him, who needed a fierce but younger little girl to be his protector. So he created an alternate theory for why he had to keep her close and all to himself. He was the protector. He was the strong one. It made his ego happy while still allowing him to have his desperate attachment to Laura. We all grew silent then because the picture was coming together clearly now. A clear, terrifying picture of our entire lives. I think about Gabe the night I went on the date with Jonathan Fielding. I think about him in the kitchen, laughing with Joe about how old Jonathan Fielding was, and how he must have slipped that note in the purse that was on the kitchen counter. And then how he must have followed me downtown, and then to the harbor, and then back to Jonathan's apartment. The police told us he'd tried to get into the building several times before the pizza delivery man held the door for him. Then he waited until the hallway was empty. He knew about Edward Riddle from an old case he'd worked on. He had it all set up, how he would lead Rosie to the harbor and then to Riddle, where she would find an entire pool of disgruntled women. He was going to help in the search for a few days until Fielding was found and I became a suspect. And then he was going to disappear with me. Only, it would seem he'd gone on a last-minute vacation with his wife. Gabe had a thick plastic bag in the trunk of his car, large enough for a body. There was also a shovel and a passport with Melissa's information, but a photograph of me. And cash and plane tickets to Indonesia. There is no extradition treaty with Indonesia. He was going to bury her body along the way. By the time her family started to wonder why she hadn't been in touch, it would have been too late, the psychologist says. It was finally time. He couldn't keep you under control from afar anymore. You were starting to meet men who were serious about you, who might want to marry you one day. He'd run out of road, so he started to pave a new one. Nothing about this seems real to me. Not yet. But I know that day will come. It will not be a good day. Where is he? I ask. The police ushered us out of that basement before they'd even put handcuffs on Gabe. Joe had arrived and was waiting out on the street, held at bay by the police. We went to his car and stayed until they took Gabe. He's being evaluated. A lawyer has been assigned and will meet with him and begin the process, she says. The process of determining if he's fit to be charged? I ask. I know how this goes. This is what happened to Lionel Casey. Lionel Casey. Another one of Gabe's victims, another burden for me to carry. She nods again. Yes. The truth is that Gabe Wallace is a deeply disturbed man. What is he saying? Rosie asks now. The woman sighs. She doesn't want to answer. But she does. He wants to see Laura. Laura. I hear my name. I say it to myself, and I know others will be saying it now. Laura, the reason my son is dead, Laura, the reason my husband is dead. Laura, the reason my father is dead. Laura, the reason my husband left us years ago. I feel the tears come again as I picture the faces of those who will be thinking my name. The Adler family, the Casey family, the Brody family. My family. How do I live with this? How do I walk this earth knowing that I caused a man to do these unspeakable things? Knowing that he will, one day, likely be free and walking among us. I know how the system works, and Gabe is smart. He knows how to hide and pretend. He's done it his whole life. He may never pay for what he's done. Kevin would tell me it's not my fault, not any of it. He would tell me I was a victim as much as anyone else, even though I am still alive. And he would tell me not to punish myself, but to move forward. To honor the lives taken by living a good life myself. He would compare me to the sole survivor of a fatal car crash, maybe someone who insisted on sitting in the back, or the target of a murder who stepped out of the way just as the gun went off, leaving another to take the bullet. Survivor's guilt is nothing new. That's what Kevin would say. Kevin was a good man. And Kevin loved me, no matter how unworthy I may be. Are we done? I ask. I think so. If we have more questions, you'll be at your sister's house? She asks. Joe and Rosie say yes together and emphatically. Joe's arm tightens around us both. I want to go to the hospital, I tell them. I want to see Jonathan Fielding. I want to be there when he wakes up, even if his family won't let me near him, even if he won't see me. Why, Laura? Rosie asks. You don't have to do that. You did nothing wrong. And I think that maybe that's true, or maybe it's not. But a thought has formed inside my heart more than my head, and I have no choice now but to trust it and to follow it. I just need to do this, I say. But that's not entirely true. The thought is this, and I hear it in the voice of Dr. Kevin Brody. My only chance now is forgiveness. I have to forgive myself for the things Gabe Wallace has done in my name, and that forgiveness will not be easy. It will be a mountain I have to climb, step by step, inch by inch. It may take a lifetime. It may never come. But the first step has to be with this man, making peace with Jonathan Fielding. And everything that happened the night before.
This is Gabra Zachman. We hope you've enjoyed The Night Before, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos. Text copyright 2019 by Wendy Walker. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.